This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network. Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Dan, today we're going to talk about probably the most important issue facing mankind, and particularly facing a new generation of young people who are aware of global warming, climate change, and the dreadful, unthinkable consequences that may follow if we don't take action. And indeed, it will have to be radical action and take it pretty soon. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program John Gibbons, who is a campaigning journalist in the cause of the environment. He's a regular contributor to the Irish Times. He had a piece in recently and has a piece coming in next weekend, I think, in the Irish Times. He has campaigned for a long time on the question of environment, global warming and climate change. And also from London, we're joined by Kirsty Gogan. She's a founder and the global director of Energy for Humanity. It's an environmental NGO. It's focused on large-scale decarbonisation and energy access. She's an advisor to the British government. And last week in Boston, she addressed in a lecture the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And it's a pleasure to welcome both John and Kirsty to The Stand. Kirsty, let me begin with you. Address you gave to MIT last week, and indeed your campaigning organization, focuses to a large extent on what you believe is an answer to this, which is nuclear. Is that a fair assessment of your position?
I think it is a fair perception. So I came to include nuclear amongst the range of low carbon solutions that we have available to us when I started crunching the numbers, looking at how the UK could achieve the 80% reduction in carbon emissions by 2050 targets using existing technologies. And I quickly realized that it was going to be extremely difficult to do that just with renewable energy, and that we were also going to need nuclear energy. And then the more I looked into it, the more I realized that, as you know, as sort of an environmentalist, I was by default anti-nuclear, and yet everything that I kind of thought I knew about nuclear was wrong.
John, nuclear in Irish minds conjures up for me Carn Sóir, which was a project in the 70s going to, I think, provide power for the country. There was massive protests. It was the focus of massive protests. It was done for.
That's right. It was Carn Sóir was kind of the foundation event, really, for the Irish Green movement, which I think is probably unfortunate, because the Green movement back in the 70s became strongly aligned with an anti-nuclear position, which, as we know, with organisations like Greenpeace, it was the anti-war movement.
Yes.
The anti-nuclear war movement, which, by the way, is a pretty good idea, became conflated with an anti-nuclear power movement. And that's really unfortunate, because we now, as Kirsty just touched on, we now find ourselves ironically in a position where we're rapidly running out of road, and we're facing a position where we've got some very difficult choices coming really fast down the track. We have to decarbonize the heck out of our energy systems. We have to go basically towards a zero carbon energy system from a situation at the moment where globally only 2-3%, Eamon, of our entire energy system at the moment is renewables based.
Yes.
And we've got to get that to, we've got to reverse that to a situation where basically we've expunged fossil fuels from our systems, from our energy systems, and completely decarbonized our way of life. Now, that, if we decide to pick and choose the types of energy that we are prepared to contemplate, well, then we have no chance of making that. And for example, here in Ireland, as you said, not only did Cairnsore happen, but we actually have legislation on our books, I think from dating back to the late 1990s, where when, for example, the government brings forward a white paper on energy, as they did recently, they're not even allowed to do a feasibility study on nuclear. So they've managed to scorch the earth around even talking about it, which yes, to my mind is ideological and impractical. We're in a tight corner, and no options, no zero carbon options can be taken off the table, irrespective of our ideological position on this.
Yeah, Kirsty, in Britain, you had the campaign for nuclear disarmament, CND, dating back to the 50s, the 60s. Very eminent leftists and people, I'd say Jeremy Corbyn would have been one of them, Michael Foot, Tony Benn, all of these people. The nuclear, as here with Cairnsore in Britain, it is associated with nuclear war, conflagration, Chernobyl even, and it's a bogeyman, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with more with what John said. That's absolutely right. The sort of the environmental movement, the mainstream environmental movement today, grew out of the peace movement, which of course really came from originally protests against bomb testing and nuclear war. And you know, I grew up myself at the height of the Cold War, and that was the great existential threat that was facing sort of young people in the mid-1980s. Today, the great existential threat that's facing us really is climate change. And, you know, I'm a new environmentalist, which means, you know, not being a technology evangelist at all, but really looking at evidence-based decision making and being very outcomes focused, which unfortunately means that we have to take, you know, another look at taboo technologies in light of the unprecedented scale of the challenge that we face in climate change. And as a result, although I support all low carbon technologies, wind and solar are very, I would say, overrepresented. They're like the charismatic fauna in the ecosystem of our energy choices. Nuclear ends up being very neglected in the climate and energy discourse. So Energy for Humanity was, you know, founded to make the environmental and humanitarian case for this technology, which means being very critical, actually, of some of the actions that have been taken, you know, by the industry in the past that, you know, have completely failed, really, to, you know, establish trust and confidence amongst the public. And, you know, really have to take that seriously and align, you know, with the values of our societies in order to be able to make a meaningful contribution towards solving this challenge. But just because the industry has, you know, behaved in unacceptable ways in the past doesn't mean that we should reject the technology. And I'll give you one reason why that's the case. You know, if we look around the world at, you know, our track record of clean energy transitions today in modern industrialized economies, the only real examples that we have, apart from countries that are very fortunate to have natural resources like geothermal and hydro, I'm thinking of Iceland and Norway, for example, the only real world examples we have of successful clean energy transitions for modern industrialized economies are Sweden, France, Switzerland, Brazil, and most recently Ontario, that have managed to completely phase out fossil fuels or almost completely phase out fossil fuels from their electricity generating mix. And they've done that through a combination of nuclear and renewables. So that's really the secret sauce here. That's the best real world experience that we have in how to do this whilst growing our GDP, whilst keeping electricity prices low for consumers and actually taking carbon dioxide out of the system.
John Gibbons, the solutions that we are, I'd like you to respond to what Kirsty just said, and she's given us concrete examples in Sweden and France, for example. What we're being told at the moment by government, our own Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, recently talked about plastic cups as something. What they're also saying is that we've got to stop producing beef, got to stop eating meat. I saw Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, his wife, saying recently that they were only having two children because they were concerned about global warming. Same time, they were flying four times in a private jet in 3 days. But we're told that incrementally, Sky ran a big plastic campaign, anti-plastic campaign. We put a tax on plastic bags, which I think was successful many years ago. And in the UK, they've recently put a tax on plastic bags in supermarkets and things like that. We're told that that's the way to go. I'm quite persuaded that it's too small, it's too incremental, and that what Kirsty is proposing and what I'd like your opinion on is we've got to look at the big, big picture here and big, big solutions and nuclear power, which we should say, and perhaps you'll confirm, there's very little waste. There's very little damage.
That's right. I mean, the waste product, if you like, for a typical family of four, say in France, where the electrical grid is 80% nuclear, the amount of nuclear waste for their electricity needs for a year would fit roughly into a Coke can. Now,
yes.
It's a very radioactive Coke can.
Yes.
But it's a Coke can. As opposed to, say, for example, here in Ireland, we 5 million of us on the island, and between us, we're accounting for 60 million tons of carbon dioxide. So that's 12 tons, Eamon, per person. Now, a lot of those tons, by the way, are accounted for by cattle, dairy cattle and beef cattle. So they're not really our tons, but collectively they're our tons. Now, how do you capture 12 tons of carbon dioxide? Where do you put it? You could certainly don't fit it in a Coke bottle, right? And it's a dispersed gas that is very persistent in the atmosphere for not just for years, but for centuries, even millennia. So the issue really is we've got to stop emitting carbon dioxide as a global emergency position. Now, where I would disagree, by the way, with Kirsty is Kirsty said we can do all these things and continue to grow GDP. I disagree with that. I believe that we're at the edge and possibly over the edge of the growth version of modern economics. The idea that we can find some new form of energy, Eamon, let's just say we renuclearize the world. If we do that within our existing economic paradigm, all that means is more energy. We will add it to coal. We will add it to peat. We will add it to oil. And we'll just say, brilliant, now we've got this clean energy. So what are we going to do with that clean energy? We're going to tear down the natural world and convert it into stuff that we're going to then sell through Amazon, that we're going to buy cheap. We're going to have fast fashion, and we're going to continue to burn down the world. Now, what we know from physics and from climate science is we're fast approaching, if not already exceeded, geophysical limits all over the system. What we cannot do, Eamon, is grow our way out of a crisis that has been delivered by
yes.
growth.
Kirsty, growth is the enemy, yet whenever there's a metric first quoted as to how any economy is doing or any government is doing, growth is the first thing that's offered up by the Minister for Finance or the government of any given country on any given day.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked in environmental issues for my whole career and, you know, become increasingly consumed with climate change as the sort of primary, most pressing issue. And, you know, unfortunately, the result of that is that we risk neglecting the other serious environmental challenges that we face around habitat loss, water scarcity, and other issues related absolutely to massive consumption, as you were describing, John.
Just let me frame the question this way. I think what John is saying, I've got him right. If we get the increased power supply that nuclear will provide for us, we won't stop because we're greedy. Our mindsets are wrong. We want to consume. So it won't, instead of replacing the current energy sources, it will be additional to. So we'll be nowhere.
Well, so here's the thing. So even if the whole of Europe and the United States agreed, you know, all of the citizens of the Western world essentially agreed to ration our consumption to sensible levels that would allow us to achieve the kind of the carbon footprint that would be sustainable, what do we tell to the citizens of India, of Africa, of Asia? Because the reality is that 3 billion people in the world, so half of the population of the world right now, lacks access to enough electricity to enjoy modern energy services. And that means, you know, having a fridge in your house or having a washing machine in your house. And about 850 million people lack access to any electricity at all, which means that the sun goes down at night and it's dark. And the impact of that, honestly, is not only a severe public health impact, because as a result of the lack of electricity, that means that you're burning smoky fuels in the home, leading to millions, 3.5 million premature deaths per year as a result of indoor air pollution, mainly impacting upon women and children, by the way, who spend the most time in the home. But it also means that it's generally women who are going to collect that fuel. So it's, you know, there was a study in, by the World Health Organization looking at the situation for women in Gujarat, where they found that women spend up to 35 hours a week just collecting fuel, so wood or dung, to burn in the home for cooking and for light. Now, that is not a productive use of time. So separating out these issues of consumption, which we absolutely have to take seriously and look at the broader environmental agenda, from our electricity generating challenge. So my organization is called Energy for Humanity, because not only do we have to reduce carbon emissions dramatically within mid-century timescales, but we also have to therefore replace our entire fossil fuel infrastructure and probably double or triple it to meet rising global energy demand. So arguing for less consumption at this point as a climate mitigation strategy, I think is not only unethical, given the reality for half of the population of the world, but also it's not our decision. The question that we should be asking is, where will that energy come from? Because access to energy profoundly affects our quality of life.
John?
Yeah, I think we need to divide out these two points, Kirsty. There's a couple of issues. Well, there's a number of issues, right? First of all, I think we can all agree, we in the Western world are over-consuming like crazy. I use the figure of 12 tons for an Irish citizen. If I was talking about an American citizen, I might be looking at 20 to 25 tons of carbon dioxide per person.
In the form of what? The food, the cars?
Everything.
The
it's our energy systems, Eamon, the goods that we consume. And in fact, these probably understate our carbon use because, for example, we all say, oh, look at China. Oh, look at all the carbon they're burning. Most of what China is burning is then being exported on ships and sold to people like us. So in fact, a lot of China's so-called carbon emissions are really hidden emissions that are actually being consumed in the West. So we in the West are over-consuming like crazy. Now, I don't believe that you can solve a global over-consumption crisis by putting a fridge in every household in India. Now, it's a nice idea, but you look at the resource implications of that. We need equity. We absolutely do. Of course we do. And we need clean energy. And for example, there's been some great initiatives, say, in Africa, for example, exactly as Kirsty described, where there's issues with air pollution and so on. And the solution they found, by the way, the scaled-down local solution in Africa that has worked really well is solar panels in African villages that have allowed them to run LEDs so that the kids, for example, can do their homework at night and so on. Well, not necessarily building nuclear power stations, Kirsty, which, and by the way, you know, you and I are kind of on the same page about this, but I think we need to be careful about simply scaling up our ambition to just build more energy into the system, because human nature and economics being what it is, we will just gobble up that energy and spit it out. And we also, I think, can agree that the natural world is running out of resources for humans to thrash through, irrespective, Kirsty, of how you and I might feel about the equity of that.
Kirstie? Yeah, so I mean, solving climate change, you can boil it down to a simple, you know, it's an energy problem. It's about how we generate energy. And then there's a second question, and I agree with you that we should separate these things out. The overconsumption in the West is absolutely critical, and we should address it. But the you ask a room full of environmentalists who are deeply, you know, worried about climate change, whether they're prepared to give up their washing machines, and I would be very surprised if many of them would be. That's the that's the reality of the situation. So, you know, if you I remember a colleague of mine who works in international development in Washington, D.C. said, oh, I'm really chuffed with myself. I bought this AAA, you know, highly energy efficient fridge. Aren't I doing well? And his colleagues pointed out to him that his fridge uses the same amount of energy in a year as the average citizen of 10 African countries.
Yes,
this is true.
This is an equity issue. So
where,
and honestly, this point about microgrids and installing solar panels, yes, there's a huge difference between having no electricity at all and then having a solar panel that enables you to power a mobile phone or an LED light or the radio. But studies are really showing that actually what that doesn't do is contribute towards increased productivity and prosperity. It doesn't actually result in the kind of economic growth that will make people more secure and live safer, longer, healthier lives that we take for granted. What's actually needed is system-wide electricity generation. And that means a grid, that means larger scale investment in energy technology.
If I just on that, Kirsty, I think we're just a little at cross purposes here. Right. I think we can agree. We're greatly, enormously over-consuming energy. Now, it's the wrong kind of energy. It's dirty energy, and the byproduct of that is unmanageable quantities of CO2. Fine. So we know that we need to get the CO2 out of the system. So we know we need to decarbonize our energy systems. I think we agree on that. So let's say that we have no choice. So let's say that we agree on that. So we remove the carbon from the system. And let's say
in the interest of the layman and the listener.
Sure.
Decarbonization is achieved by what means? John,
critically, decarbonization. The main sources of carbon dioxide emissions in the world at the moment are energy systems, our energy production and transport, and then beyond that, agriculture. But principally, it is about how we produce our energy and the emissions from burning of fossil fuels. That is the number one source of carbon in the world. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Well, Chrissy.
Yeah, so globally, let's say it's roughly a fifth for making electricity. And then broadly speaking, the rest, the 80% that's left, is roughly speaking heat, which is for making things like cement and steel and concrete. So high temperature heat that we produce by burning fossil fuels.
Transport.
To make those important. And then of course transport, within which we would include shipping and aviation and personal transport. Essentially it's liquid fuel. So it's gas and oil. And interestingly, the amount of the contribution from those fossil fuels, in the overall mix has not changed one iota since the 1960s until today. So despite 30 years of successfully building public and political support for action on climate change, we have not made a dent in the upward trajectory of emissions. Not a single dent. So whatever we've been doing to date is not working.
I have to completely and absolutely agree with Kirsty on this. 1990, Eamon, is probably the year that we can agree that global action, if you like, on the climate crisis really officially kicked off.
Al Gore was an important figure in this, wasn't he?
He was a figure, for sure.
Yes.
But the process really was the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. That kicked off in about 88 to 1990. And that basically said that the governments of the world have finally come up with a structure for dealing with this. Now, between 1990 and today, let's look at what happened. Global emissions have gone up by about 60% in the 30 years in which we have known absolutely that climate change represents an existential threat to the future of human civilization. Now, that suggests to me that our growth-based economy is beginning to look more and more like a death cult.
Yes.
And I mean, that sounds like an extreme way of putting it. But when the governments of the world get together in rooms and agree basically to go down a pathway that they know for certain will lead to complete system failure and economic collapse and biodiversity failure and horrors beyond imagination by the middle of this century, then to me, that looks like a death cult. And again, what's driving that cult is this idea of economic growth by yes. any means, whether it's a fossil fuel power growth or a nuclear power growth or a solar panel power growth. But the idea that we can continue to spread this disease called prosperity around the world, because people have a right, apparently, to prosperity no matter what, even if that prosperity undermines their own ability to survive in the future. So if, for example,
John,
we deliver fridges, Kirsty, all over the world, right? Let's say we get all those fridges that you're talking about into Bangladesh, into India. We will improve people's lives in the short term and immiserate them in the medium term by pushing up energy demand, by pushing up resource demand, and by basically bringing system failure closer. People who are living poorly today are much closer to sustainability than people like myself, yourself, and Eamon. We're the ones who are living unsustainably.
John, I just can't really understand or get behind a climate mitigation strategy that relies upon poor people staying poor.
Kirsty, in fairness, primarily, and I think to understand my point.
By contrast, you know, if we're talking about behavior change, if we're relying upon people to change their behavior at a personal level, to make personal sacrifices, that to me is first of all quite unlikely, and secondly very high risk. Given the urgency that we face, if we had the luxury of time, then maybe things would be different. But the reality is, the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, so the, you know, the world's scientific consensus on climate change, indicate that we need to cut carbon emissions by global carbon emissions, not only from the power sector, but across all of those other sectors that we mentioned, you know, heat, transport, agriculture, by 50% by 2030 and by pretty much 80 to 100% by mid-century. That scale of transition, we cannot rely on individuals to make sacrifices.
I wasn't suggesting that, by the way.
Just to give you an example, I used to work in government, and it took 10 years and millions of pounds of government spending on TV advertising to persuade people to wear seatbelts in their cars, a decade of millions of pounds, to do something that was directly in their own interest. So I understand what you're saying about overconsumption, but I think the solution here is that we have to develop new technologies and new products which allow people to substitute the unsustainable options for more sustainable and resource.
John, you were getting extremely agitated and frustrated listening to Kirsty there, because I think just before I let you on back in, and we're not on a radio show, so we can take our time and make complex arguments at leisure. Is nuclear the main route to solving this? Is that what you're saying, Kirsty?
Are you asking me?
Yes.
Well, so as an environmentalist, one of the reasons that I support nuclear energy is because it's incredibly dense, and John already mentioned the tiny volumes of waste that are created. And you know, if you have a kilogram of coal, it will power a light bulb for about 4 days. If you have a kilogram of uranium, it will power the same light bulb for 685 years. And the impact of that, very, very dense, a million times more dense than coal, is that you have a tiny environmental footprint, which means that you could have a very small footprint to power, you know, city scale.
Yes.
City scale energy without emissions.
Let me go back to John. John, your agitation there and your the point, I think, that Kirsty's making, well, you know the point she's made, so
yeah.
And our listeners know the point she's making.
No, I think
it's an interesting point.
They're very interesting points. And again, you know, I think there's many points of agreement here. And as you say, Eamon, that the purpose of this type of discussion is to tease out the fine grain, not to say it's black and it's white. And I think both myself and Kirsty and you, we know that. There's none of the above. There's a lot of grey. But I really think we need to look at the models, right? For example, if we consider, what do we consider success, right? Do we consider a country with massive GDP to be a successful country?
No, but I think what we consider success is what Kirsty pointed to, the targets for 2030 and the target for 2050. Meeting those targets, well, I think we would consider success. Is that right, Kirsty?
Well, at the moment.
Well, we know what success looks like. Which success looks like Sweden.
Okay, John.
Success looks like Switzerland, which has an electrified, clean electrified transport fleet, zero emissions, clean air, prosperous, productive society where people are living a very good quality of life. They're living longer, safer, healthier, more productive lives than at any other point in history.
Okay, John.
But we do
that's what success looks like.
Sure, Kirsty, but you know, I think, as well as I do, that the world, 7 billion people in the world, cannot live like the citizens of Sweden or the citizens of Switzerland, because they, while they may have cleaned
they're
up
starting
their own,
from a lower base,
because they may have cleaned up their own doorsteps. And I think Norway is a wonderful example, right? For example, Norway is now transitioning towards electric cars. It's transitioning towards, a post carbon society. But Norway, Eamon, has €1 trillion in the bank.
Yes.
From
oil.
Statoil and from oil. So basically they exported their dirty business. They cashed in the profits and now they turn around and say, well, look, we're a low energy country. So they're not. The balance sheets of rich countries in every part of the world are completely skewed. For example, recently we had a thing, Eamon, called World Overshoot Day, right? What that says is this is the day in the year at which the world has consumed more resources than it can renew in the year. Now, that day occurred this year on the 29th of July. It's the earliest ever. However, Ireland's version of World Overshoot Day happened on the 27th of April. And I can assure you that Switzerland's World Overshoot Day happened in April or May, and so did Norway and so did Sweden. These are rich countries. We cannot continue to live like this. We simply can't. We can't continue, for example, to hop on airplanes and fly off to America for a conference. We can't just buzz off to the Maldives for holidays. Those days are over. These are all, and we're not going to replace aircraft with nuclear power anytime soon. What we have to understand...
But we may replace the fuels that are powering the aircraft.
Well, Kirsty, when we have replaced those fuels...
With clean synthetic fuels.
Sure, but when we've done that, Kirsty, let's start flying again. In the meanwhile, we need to decarbonize, and we, you and I, people like us, need to represent or to accept as environmentalists that we operate in a system with severe limits. And we have a cap. There's a global cap of all the carbon that can ever be released for the next 1,000 years. And that cap is about 600 billion tons. Now, you probably know as well as I do that at the moment we're burning through about 40 billion tons a year. Which means that we're, well, maybe 35 billion tons a year. That means within about 12 to 15 years, the total carbon budget for the next 1,000 years for humanity to avoid 1.5 to 2 degrees centigrade is gone. And these are the numbers. Now, you can finesse them and you can say we'll do more of this and we'll change our system to that. These are the numbers. We have to figure out how not to burn through the remaining 650 billion tons of our carbon quota. And how do we do that? And we sure as heck don't do that by growing.
Kirsty?
Well, John... It's not that I don't agree with you, but what worries me is that I don't see a believable, realistic strategy for operationalizing your proposal. I don't see how, within the timescales that we have available to us, we will create the political mandate, not only in Europe and in the United States, and Australia, the developed countries, for a dramatic reduction universally applied across all citizens, how we would mandate that, and the risks associated politically in attempting to do that.
Kirsty, I agree with you.
Betting the farm on that strategy.
Kirsty, can I agree with you?
What do we do about those countries for whom the leaders of those countries, the first priority is getting access to energy to those citizens?
Absolutely.
Because it's so profoundly important to their well-being and quality of life. To me, it doesn't feel like a realistic strategy, and therefore it's very high risk.
Kirsty, you're absolutely
and
right.
Really, what we're talking, we agree about the nature of the risk. So I'm surprised that's what's on offer here.
This is a high risk situation.
I have one other question, which is that as an environmentalist, you're very, I listened to your previous podcast. You're breadth and depth of knowledge is really, really impressive. And I just wonder how you feel about the mainstream environmental movements, dogged opposition to nuclear energy, considering everything that we know about the track record and the potential for this technology?
Well, I mean, just to start again, let's find a point of agreement. I think it's always good to find a point of agreement. And I've made that, I was saying that to Eamon a little bit earlier. You know, I've stuck my neck out here in Ireland by writing and speaking on the radio in favour of nuclear energy into not a headwind, but a storm. Right. Because it's one of those sacred cows in Ireland that you can't talk about. So, look, I'm with you on that.
It's taboo.
It is taboo.
Yeah. And it takes, and I have to say, it takes a lot of courage to do that, to, because, you know, climate and energy discourse is loaded with this kind of, you know, identity politics. And I feel your pain, because as an environmentalist,
absolutely,
this technology does risk, you know, us being shunned from our tribe.
And, absolutely. And, and you're right about that. There is the tribal element to it, where we want to show that we're doing the right thing, and we're staying on side with people. Mm. I'd be honest, we're in an emergency. And in my view, in an emergency, I don't really care about my tribe all that much. What I care about is the wider tribe called humanity and the biosphere. Yeah. So that helps me as an individual to focus on what I think are the bigger pictures. You asked the question, Kirsty, and I think you're right. You know, my prescription is not a prescription that is full of hope, but I just don't know what the prescription is, because I know for a fact, unfortunately, that we have hard limits. And nobody in the world is saying how we're going to manage them.
Can I ask you a question? You particularly, John, because as Kirsty has pointed out, your knowledge is impressive of the scale and nature of the problem. Our own Green Party, supposed to be the advocates for, you know, saving this planet from this curse of growth, how are they matching up?
I think nobody's perfect. I think the Green Party in Ireland...
I mean, why are they not talking, it occurs to me, about nuclear? Why are they not pointing to the successes in Sweden? Why are they not pointing to Switzerland? Why, for example, our near neighbour France, where I've lived for extensive periods, and the success of nuclear power there? Why are they not allowing us to know about this?
I think it's a good point. And I remember writing a piece about this before, and I quoted Bill McKibben, who's a very famous environmental author and campaigner. And Bill McKibben was quoted somewhere along the way as saying that, you know, whatever his own feelings about nuclear power, it would split the tribe, to use Kirsty's analogy earlier, if he were to really put it out there. And the feeling, therefore, is that it's somewhere you can't go. And I have a feeling, and I've had these conversations.
Is it somewhere we should go?
Of course it is. Absolutely. This is an emergency. I know I sound like a broken record now.
No, but
in fact, it even says it on the T-shirt, right? We are in a climate emergency. And when you're in an emergency situation, the first thing is everything is on the table. All your sacred cows, all your Holy Marys, get rid of them. What you say is, this is an emergency. What do we do next? And the timescales aiming for action are staggeringly short. And I'm sure this is something Kirsty is aware of, that one of the big issues with nuclear, and I'm sure people listening to this will be aware, especially with the planning process and so on, and especially with hostility, you could be looking at many, not decades rather than years, to get to deploy nuclear on a wide scale. By the way, I'm still in favour of it, but I don't think it's a magic wand or a silver bullet.
Okay, secret sauce, I think, is the phrase.
Indeed.
The metaphor that Kirsty is. Kirsty, John has been very candid about our own Green Party. In the UK, for example, would we be looking at broadly the same thing among conventional environmentalists?
I mean, I think those mainstream environmentalists that grew up out of the peace movement have this sort of anti-nuclear tendency in their DNA, but you know, I think one thing I'd like to also, you know, put on the table here is the idea that I think history will judge our actions today. David Wallace Wells, who wrote Uninhabitable Earth, an excellent book on climate, he pointed out that we have emitted half of all of the carbon emissions that are currently in the atmosphere today in the last 30 years. And broadly speaking, as we've been discussing, we have another 30 years really to sort of turn the tanker here. So we're our generation, you know, is at a pivotal moment in determining how we will act, how we will respond to this planetary emergency. And one of the things that I think history will judge us is the way that we've categorized climate change as an environmental issue. Now, that might sound a little odd, but actually one of the things that really scares me about, you know, what's on the cards here for my daughters and all of our children's future is that when people start to feel threatened, insecure, vulnerable, as we're already starting to see as these, you know, natural disasters are, you know, beating down on us, not just in places like Bangladesh and faraway remote places, but at home as well, in the United States, in Europe, we can all now look out the window and point at impacts related to climate change. When people start to feel afraid and insecure and threatened, what that does is create, unfortunately, fertile ground for very unsavory political leaders to start taking hold. And we can look at the impacts that arguably a million refugees arriving in Europe recently has contributed towards the rise of the populist right in Europe. What happens when there's 100 million refugees?
Okay. John, I leave the last word with you. I found this as a layman and someone who has certainly not fulfilled any obligations to the environment, but is interested and engaged now. It's in one sense depressing to listen to you and Kirsty, because you don't seem to believe, either of you, with good reason, that we're going to come to terms with what we have to do, are we?
Well, first of all, who knows? I mean, that's not a facetious answer.
No.
We don't know for sure.
You've talked about a death cult.
Yeah, but we're currently configured as a death cult.
Yes.
And I would include, by the way, our own government in that.
Yes.
The non-engagement, the insanity, for example, 20 years after the EU told us to stop burning peat, we're still burning peat. And now we're demonizing environmentalists for pointing this out 20 years later. So yeah, there's that element. Now, the problem is the maths are not good here. Right. What is required? I think Kirsty used the analogy of turning the tanker around, which I think is a pretty good analogy. I think it's turning the oil tanker around, okay? Turning away from fossil fuels. Can we do that without crashing the global economy? I don't know, right? If you were to pin me in a corner and say, well, what do you think? I would say, no, I don't think we can.
Right.
I don't think it's possible to avoid a global depression if we implement the kind of swinging changes that are required here. And of course, people say, well, you can't do that. There is a choice, though, between a global depression and planetary immiseration. Now, at the moment, that's not a wonderful choice.
No.
And I wish that we were having this conversation 20 years ago, when a lot of these things were still theoretical, when we had time and space to make sort of delicate and graded changes, where we could sit around and think about, well, I like this, but I don't like that. We're now, unfortunately, we didn't have those conversations. We just basically burned like there's no tomorrow. Now we've pushed ourselves into a corner and we're left in a position where all the choices, Eamon, that we now face are rotten. And we've got to choose the least rotten choices available to us.
Okay, that's all we have time for on this occasion. But I would like to return. I leave the last word with you, Kirsty, having already left it with John, because both of you have persuaded me that there's something very important here, and it's more important than the next 2 minutes of my time.
Well, all I would say is that I am more optimistic, actually, that this is entirely solvable, and it's solvable by looking again at a taboo technology that has been systematically excluded from the discourse that's been dominated by the environmental movement over the past 30 years. And that if we really are brave and courageous to open our eyes and look at that, you know, broader range of options, then we can use nuclear technology to produce cost-effective synthetic clean fuels to replace gas and oil in our diesel engines and combined cycle gas turbines. And we can replace, you know, through a combination of wind and solar and nuclear energy, as has been demonstrated in the real world, a dirty electricity generation. We can do this. We know what success looks like, but we need to take a deep breath and look again at some of those options that have currently, you know, been excluded from the discussion. So thanks so much for being open to that, John. I'm really impressed and admire your courage.
Okay.
Great to talk to you too, Kirsty.
I'd like to thank Kirsty Gogan, who's the founder and global director of Energy for Humanity, and an advisor to the British government, and also John Gibbons, a campaigning journalist for the environment. Look out for a piece he's writing for the Irish Times. He contributes regularly to that newspaper. I'd like to thank Kirsty and John. I'd like to thank all of you for listening. I've learned quite a bit in the last 45 minutes. This is one of the most interesting conversations I've had, or listened to rather, for quite some time. That's all we have time for. We'll talk to you soon.